I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. It takes a lot of giant technology to have a small USB charger delivered to your front door. We're talking about ocean vessels the size of the Empire State Building, huge cranes lifting massive containers on and off these ships, 18-wheel long-haul trucks, and warehouses the size of many football fields. Our guest, Christopher Mims, decided to track the delivery of a small charger to better understand the global supply chain, what it takes to move products, big and small, all over the world. He writes in his new book, Arriving Today, that this tiny, inexpensive gadget is the embodiment of the journey of billions of dollars worth of other goods, part of the creative destruction that has permanently transformed the way we live. That's a quote. Online shopping has taken off in recent years, especially during the pandemic. Trucks delivering packages to homes and apartments are now a common sight everywhere. So today on Radio Times, who are these people along this supply chain? How does this supply chain work? What is it like to work these jobs? Is there a way that we want to buy things? And what's behind the delays in the supply chain? Christopher Mims is technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us by Skype. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So glad to be here with you.
Of all the products, why did you pick a USB charger to track?
Well, in the past, others had traced things like, you know, the T-shirt. It struck me that the USB charger was sort of the modern equivalent in our technological age. Also, it's a surprisingly sophisticated device. It's got microchips in it and little PCB boards. So a country that's capable of making a USB charger is well on its way to making a lot more sophisticated things and a wide variety of other goods. Turns out a lot of these are made in Vietnam. And of course, Vietnam does make a great variety of goods that we usually think of as being made in China. So everything from personal protective equipment and furniture to AirPods and Samsung smartphones
all come from Vietnam. In fact, you say that's the sort of future of manufacturing is not necessarily China, but Southeast Asia.
Yeah, a lot of stuff still gets made in China, but China has such a huge domestic market that it's consuming more and more of its own goods. And, you know, wages have risen significantly in China. So, you know, the quest is always for the next place where labor is affordable. Southeast Asia is close to China. It's close to the supply chains that provide all the components that go into a lot of goods, you know, whether that's synthetic thread that gets woven into, you know, ultimately athleisure, or the microchips that go into a USB charger or a smartphone. So those things can, you know, sort of flow out of China and into Vietnam, Thailand, you know, through places like Malaysia, sometimes also India. And, you know, once they're assembled, they can get on a boat and cross the Pacific Ocean to America or go the other direction to European markets.
Do we know how many gadgets, products are shipped through this global supply chain?
Well, if you're talking about out of Southeast Asia, you know, it's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods. It's all the AirPods, more or less. It's every Samsung smartphone, pretty much. Tons of other devices of that kind. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because this book starts, you know, as the pandemic is starting. That's just, I'm assuming, Christopher Mims, just a kind of coincidence that's when you began to track this USB device. But I want to make sure that our listeners understand that something else really serious was going on, also part of this global crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I found supply chains, which are usually kind of a boring, mundane topic, so interesting because they were changing so much because of e-commerce. And then at the same time, because of tensions between the US and China, which was causing a lot of companies to so-called dual source. So they would literally set up a copy of their factories in China in a place like Vietnam so that, you know, if there were, you know, tariffs, because, of course, the president at the time was threatening a trade war with China and slapping tariffs on various goods, those goods could still, you know, arrive in the US. I mean, a company like Nike, which is heavily dependent on, you know, East Asia and Southeast Asia for manufacturing, they couldn't be in a position where they simply couldn't provide shoes if there was a trade war, or God forbid, a shooting war in the South China Sea.
Well, and also this demand, I mean, not everyone went home, but so many people did go home. across the world. And I'm assuming once people were home in front of their computers, then the demand for things went up. Yes?
Yeah. I mean, that was what was really wild was I was standing on the dock at a terminal watching containers be lifted onto a ship in Vietnam. And it was the day that the World Health Organization was like, coronavirus is a threat. There's this thing happening in Wuhan. And so, you know, all of those goods that I was watching be loaded onto ships, again, everything from personal protective equipment to, you know, tons of electronics and doodads that people were going to buy so they could start working from home, that was going onto the ship that day. And, you know, e-commerce, of course, had been growing at a steady clip for decades, but it really exploded. All the analysts I've talked to have said that adoption of, you know, delivery of e-commerce, you know, everything from groceries to everyday goods to food was accelerated by a decade by the pandemic. And of course, now we're in a place where not only was it accelerated by a decade, but it's pretty much held steady, right? People are going back to stores, people are going back to restaurants, but overall, the level of consumption of delivered goods has stayed at that very high level.
This is a little aside, but I thought it was interesting when you look at, as you described, when you look at the infrastructure in Vietnam, it's about barges and boats and ports. Things are transferred through the waterway, not through roads as we have largely in this country.
Yeah, this is one of the fascinating things about supply chains and manufacturing and economies wherever you go is, you know, we think of them as kind of dematerialized because, oh, all this stuff comes to us through the internet. But no, every place you go, people are leveraging whatever natural features, whatever geographic advantages they have. You know, and in Vietnam, they don't have a lot of road and rail infrastructure, but they don't need it because it's so efficient to move goods on the water. I mean, this is why the total mass of goods moved down the Mississippi River in the United States to this day is greater than all of the other rail and road freight that we move by mass, I should say. It's just such a kind of like marvelously efficient way to move stuff. So in Vietnam, you know, there are these factories that are kind of, you know, north up the Saigon River, and all the finished goods that they create, they, you know, they put them into shipping containers and then they go onto these barges, which don't carry more than 80 shipping containers apiece. And it's this whole culture of these long barges and men who kind of basically live on them and just ferry goods up and down the river, this 8-hour journey from the factories down to the ports that face the ocean.
Well, let's talk about, I mentioned in my introduction that the size of some of these ships that are then crossing the Pacific, ending up largely in Los Angeles. But we're talking about ships, as you described, the size, the length of the Empire State Building. But obviously, it's even more than that because it's more than just length.
Yeah. So, I mean, a ship that's 3 football fields long, 15 stories tall. The biggest of them can carry up to 10,000 40-foot shipping containers. Every shipping container can hold 60,000 pounds of goods. So it is a giant Empire State Building's worth of finished goods, because of course these ships are distinct from the type that carry like grain or oil or whatever. And they are, yeah, they're crossing the Pacific Ocean on a regular basis. There are about 5,000 container ships in the world's fleet. Not all of them are this big. They have to move a vast amount of material and they have to do it efficiently. And of course, that's, you know, they couldn't do it without the shipping container.
Indeed. And inside that giant shipping container on that giant ship is your small USB charger.
Yeah. So if you imagine the, you know, the journey of, you know, we take it for granted that you just click on a button and then something gets delivered to you the next day or 2 days or the same day. But that journey is 14,000 miles long at least. And that's just from when it's manufactured to you. And, you know, it takes nowadays because of delays at ports, it could take up to 4 months. In the best circumstances, it might take a couple of months. And so, you know, you imagine something that you order is something as mundane as a cable. You know, we're all losing cables constantly, right? And having to replenish them. You know, that cable went on this absolutely enormous journey. There was just tons of automation machines, even robots, and hundreds of humans who had to get it to you or even, you know, handle the box that it was in before it finally went on that truck for that last mile journey to you so you could get it the next day.
A couple of years ago, I, for some weird reason, I ordered some large decorative safety pins. You know, this is what happens sometimes. And when it, when they did finally arrive, I saw they did. They came from China, and I, a little light bulb went on my head, thinking, "Wait a minute, what did it take to get these safety pins to my front door?"
Yeah, it's unreal that we have made the transportation of goods so efficient and so cheap that, you know, now it costs less to ship those goods from wherever labor is cheapest, from wherever the supply chains already exist, from wherever environmental regulations are the most lax, all the way around the world to us, rather than, you know, make it somewhere nearby.
You do describe what it's like to actually be a member of the crew on some of these ships that are carrying these containers across the oceans. Describe for our listeners the kind of day in the life of a member of the crew.
So modern container ships are a great example of the way that just an enormous amount of technological evolution has kind of simplified the jobs of the sailors who are on these ships, also made them more individually valuable because, you know, these crews have actually been shrinking over the years. You might have a couple of dozen sailors on a ship the size of a skyscraper. And, you know, their routine is, if they're on watch, which a lot of them are rotating through watch duty, you know, it's 4 hours on, 4 hours off. And, you know, they have somewhat irregular schedules because it's a 24-hour cycle. It's like being in an ER doc or something. And, you know, other than that, they're sort of confined to the habitable areas of the ship. It's almost like a spaceship. Or some people have told me that it's just like kind of just living in a building for 6 months while they're at sea. You know, you watching the sunrise and set, and that can be beautiful. But after a while, it gets old because that's all just sort of out the window.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but you almost described prison-like conditions. And maybe this was during the height of COVID when you know, you couldn't get off a ship because of worries about the virus.
Yeah, I mean, it can be prison-like even on the best of times. But during COVID, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of sailors worldwide who were held on ships, you know, sometimes for months beyond their original contracts because, you know, various countries wouldn't let them get off and fly home because of their own COVID restrictions. So for sailors, it really became, you know, the bodies that regulate it stopped short of calling it slavery, but they just weren't allowed to stop working.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. That's Christopher Mims. He's technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal. His new book is about the details, the inside of the global supply chain. His book is titled Arriving Today. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about what it takes to get a package delivered to your front door. Our guest is tech writer Christopher Mims, author of a book called Arriving Today. It's about the marvels, also the dark side of the global supply chain. He tracked a USB charger from Vietnam to its arrival in the United States. Do you shop online? Chances are you do. We want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. So, Christopher, let's get back on the ship. It's making its way to Long Beach, California, which is where you say about 40% of ships, I guess, full of these containers make their arrival. You also describe what it's like to essentially kind of parallel park a 1,200-foot ship. How do you do that?
Yeah, so the Port of Los Angeles, Long Beach, it's two separate ports, but they're directly adjacent to one another and they're treated as one. And through them goes, you know, nearly half of the goods that come into the United States are imported. And in order to get that ship, you know, quayside so that cranes can take all those containers off, this very difficult thing has to happen, which is that a special kind of pilot called a harbor pilot has to get onto that container ship, you know, when it's ready to come in. And they have to have this incredibly detailed knowledge of everything about this port. And it's partly because the ships are so big relative to the size of the port. The tolerances are so narrow. Sometimes when they go under a bridge, for example, they have to be cognizant of how hot it is because that can make the bridge sag.
Oh, my gosh.
Nearly scrape them. Yeah. You know, and then, of course, on the bottom, some of these ships are just, you know, a meter or two above the bottom of the ship channel that they're traveling through. So these harbor pilots, you know, they're compensated very well. They're among the most experienced captains on the ocean. You know, they usually have long careers traversing the ocean beforehand. And when they bring these ships in, they are using all of this technology to kind of localize the ship down to the centimeter. You know, it's like two different types of GPS, for example. And they have tugboats, which are attached to the ship, which they're really using to help redirect it or break it. And there's actually a turning basin inside the port of Los Angeles, for example, where as they're coming up into this deep part of the port, they just cut the engines of the ship completely. And they really have to kind of direct the tugboats to just help the ship just sort of coast.
Wow.
Right into this spot, which where there can be two giant ships on either end. So it is parallel parking this, you know, absolutely enormous building size thing, dealing with all the sort of hydrodynamics of the water underneath. And, you know, they really have to kind of stick the landing. They, in order for all the kind of hookups to electricity and fuel and stuff to work, a lot of times they have to get the ship till within a meter of its ultimate destination. And they just kind of glide it into place. So it's this incredibly tricky job to have. And that's why you can't have just an everyday pilot get your ship into port.
In fact, you mentioned they're very well compensated. And frankly, as you just described, I'm really glad they are. We're talking about something like more than $400,000 a year to be a pilot, harbor pilot.
Yeah, that's their salary, and they're civil servants. I think they're the best compensated workers in the city of Los Angeles.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from James. He says, "Is the shortage of dock workers in California related to there being fewer workers or demand that the existing workforce can handle?" And this, of course, gets to some of the delays and shortages that we're dealing with today. You describe, you know, the longshoremen who work the docks in Longport in California. What do you say?
Well, I mean, that's tricky because there are unionized longshoremen, as they're called, working the ports there. But there's also this kind of whole other class of hourly workers, which, you know, is part of the union contract, who can be called up on any given day. And so I think a lot of the challenge there is not that there's a shortage per se, like there's just not enough of these people, or there's not as many as there used to be. It's that there is just absolutely unprecedented demand. So the combined port of LA Long Beach is going to probably process a total of 10 million containers this year. That's a record.
Wow.
Well, I mean, when I was writing my book, it was 8.5 million. Month after month, they're smashing records for the number of containers that they get into the port, to the point that there are now other bottlenecks other than the people who work in the port. There's bottlenecks with there aren't enough trucks. There aren't enough truck chassis to carry all of these shipping containers out of the port. There's not enough warehouse space in the Inland Empire to accept all the goods that are being trucked out of these ports. So, you know, the ports are an issue, but there's bottlenecks throughout that supply chain, which are limiting the amount of material which can be put through it.
I was reading there's even a shortage of containers. Is that true?
Yeah. And again, the issue is that it's unprecedented demand, and the supply is kind of in the wrong place. So that we've always had this imbalance where, because we import so much more from Asia than we export, it's been difficult to get empty containers back to Asia, because who wants to take those containers over? you know, so sometimes they would kind of meander around the country and end up in the Midwest and then get filled with agricultural commodities like soybeans. That's not happening now because you have companies like IKEA that are like, we're going to buy a bunch of containers. These are our containers. So when you have big companies like Home Depot just basically has like the SS Home Depot now, like they have their own ship that they've booked. So when the companies with deeper pockets kind of sequester some part of the supply chain for themselves, it helps them guarantee that their goods are going to get delivered on time. But that just takes more and more capacity out of the general market for transporting goods that everybody else is relying on.
So are we seeing just traffic jams, boat after boat after boat, just waiting to dock and unload their supplies?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the issue is that, you know, demand, companies thought demand was going to drop at the beginning of the pandemic. They thought that the recession that we had, you know, with unemployment and the rest was going to be like the Great Recession, but that didn't happen, right? The people worked from home, the economy kept churning, people ordered more and more stuff. And so instead, what you ended up with was unprecedented demand and a really hot economy. And so unprecedented demand plus everyone is kind of racing to catch up to order enough stuff. You just end up with a huge, it's literally a traffic jam, right? Just like a traffic jam forms on a highway where some congestion leads to more congestion, leads to more congestion. That's exactly what's happening, especially in ports, but throughout the supply chain, all the way down to warehouses and throughout, you know, trucking.
Here's a comment from a listener wanting to know the cost of the charger when you break it down from manufacturing, shipping costs, profit, and all that. I forget what a USB charger actually costs a consumer, but is it possible to break down that price?
I mean, it's challenging with an object like this, but let me give you some perspective on something else where I do know the numbers. Before the pandemic, the cost to ship a large flat panel television from China to the United States was $2 per television, wow, which just shows you how incredibly efficient this system is. So once you pack all those TVs into a shipping container and you know, get it on a giant ship, the shipping cost was tiny, was negligible. And so, you know, typically on something very small, you know, the shipping cost is just going to be pennies. Of course, now to reserve that same shipping container is going to be 10 times as much if you can even get it. So what we're seeing now is lower margin goods, smaller things where you have lower profits, are just getting squeezed out of global supply chains. So, you know, a lot of the kind of tchotchkes and knickknacks or just random stuff that you might have gotten in the past, those shippers just might not be able to profitably get it to you at all.
So my large decorative safety bins probably wouldn't.
There might be a run on this.
Exactly. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Christopher Mims. He's technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal. He's got a new book. It's titled Arriving Today, From Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy. And it is about the global supply chain. You can join us, and a lot of people want to do. Questions, comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Christopher, you mentioned efficiency, and you do described about Taylor and sort of our Taylorized system. This goes back decades, but help us understand how that has kind of transformed the work environment and how we think about things like efficiency and standardization and productivity.
Yeah, so this is a Philadelphia story.
Yeah.
I mean, Frederick Taylor, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, he was a machinist. You know, he worked, you know, making, you know, metal objects in a machine shop, which at the time was kind of, you could barely describe it as a factory because there was no assembly line, for example. And he is the reason we have what is known today as scientific management, which to me is the most important theory since, you know, Marxism or capitalism. But it's sort of unknown to us because it fell into disfavor. Also, it's kind of the water we swim in. But he was the originator, along with, to be fair, Henry Ford, of the idea that you could measure every single thing that a factory worker did and try to economize and eliminate steps and make all of those physical movements that that person made more efficient so that they could work at a faster pace, so that they could turn out, you know, more widgets per hour. So it's an idea that really came about at the same time as the assembly line was invented, because of course Ford needed his manufacturing workers to be able to keep up with this physically moving assembly line. You know, that became a variety of management theories. It became Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, who were famous because of the Disney movie Cheaper by the Dozen. They were management experts. They were disciples of Frederick Taylor. Lillian Gilbreth, after the death of her own husband, said, you know, let's apply Taylorism to the kitchen. She's the reason that the modern kitchen is designed the way it is, with like a kitchen island and things like that, and the sink where it is, because she thought, oh, let's make kitchens more efficient. It will liberate women from, you know, unnecessary steps in the kitchen. And, you know, if you've ever, you know, used a productivity hack or kind of tried to monitor your own productivity, you are sort of enacting the legacy of this whole idea of scientific management.
Let me get back to our USB charger. It finally makes it off the container ship, and now it's put into a long haul truck. You hop aboard with a driver, actually a guy, he's from Philadelphia, as it turns out, a guy named Robert. Obviously the destination is some warehouse somewhere. What's it like to ride with him in this big truck?
Well, riding in a big truck really made me appreciate a number of things about truck drivers. I mean, one is that their job is much more stressful and dangerous than I think is widely appreciated. And, you know, part of that is because they're in this giant truck. It's not very maneuverable. You know, it can take a couple of football fields to bring it to a complete stop from a highway speed. And, you know, they are using the same highways that we are. And, you know, a couple times an hour, somebody is cutting them off, which you should never do. You always got to give them at least 100 feet. And also, you know, modern American long haul truck drivers are a lot of them trapped in a system where, you know, they are on the road an average of 21 days out of every month. They're working 14 hours a day. They're getting paid by the mile. They're not paid for the time that they're sitting around waiting at a warehouse for their truck to be loaded or unloaded. And, you know, they're not making anywhere near the wage they made, you know, 30, 40 years ago before trucking was deregulated.
Well, did we lose our guest? I heard a little, we did. We lost our guest. Okay. We heard a little blip, and that's usually a sound that we have lost our guest, but we will get him back. Let me just quickly reintroduce him. Talking with Christopher Mims, he's technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about the global supply chain, something that he explores in his new book called Arriving Today. And I'm just wondering if I can read a couple of tweets. We have to call. We have a call if you want to take the listener. Okay, I'm just reading. I got several screens here. And, yeah, let's take a call from Tom. Can we do that? We can do that. Okay. Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. My name is Tom. I'm a small manufacturer. I make custom equipment for scientific researchers. And, you know, the cost of things, because so much stuff gets shipped internationally, the cost of things is just unbelievable. In 2019, I sent a piece of equipment to Germany, and I sent it by Federal Express. It cost me $1,400. Huh. Last week, I sent another piece of equipment, same size, same shape, same everything, to Sweden, and it cost me $3,400.
Wow. So $2,000 more. Wow, Tom.
$2,000 more. In addition to that, the supply chain for the incoming supply chain for stuff that I buy in order to assemble these devices has just been absolutely crazy.
Right.
Normally, I buy a piece of basically extruded aluminum tubing to build frames, and usually the the wait time between the order and the reception is about 20 days. It's 100.
It's 100 days now. Tom, hold on, because we have Christopher Mims back, and I just want to give him a chance to respond to you. You're talking about, obviously, you know, exponential increase in shipping things as a guy with a small manufacturing company, but also the wait times as well. Chris, can you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of been spoiled in that for a long time, we've lived in a world where we really had excess shipping capacity. So, you know, international freight companies would, during, you know, boom times, kind of overbuild. There'd be too many ships, and then they would have to pare them back when there wasn't enough demand. You know, because we're in a time of absolutely unprecedented demand, and everyone is trying to, you know, ship stuff all at once, and there's all this congestion, what that means is that the spot market, so if you're not a giant shipper that has reserved shipping way, way, way in advance, that spot market has gone crazy because there's just no capacity there whatsoever. So it doesn't surprise me at all that there's kind of this exponential increase in shipping costs for especially, you know, small and medium sized businesses.
Exponential increase and also the delays. Tom, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'll tell you what, we're going to have to take a very short break. So Christopher Mims, stay with us. And we are talking about the global supply chain, something that Christopher Mims explores in his new book. It's called Arriving Today. And again, tracking a USB charger from a factory in Vietnam where it was made into a container ship across the Pacific Ocean into LA, put on a truck, and then, of course, ending up eventually at a warehouse. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And like Tom, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Christopher Mims about the global supply chain and his new book called Arriving Today. Christopher, we lost you for a second, and we were in the middle of talking with you about this long-haul trucker. And I just wanted to underscore something that you said about, and I remember doing interviews when being a long-haul truck driver meant a really good income. I mean, you know, $100,000 or more. Now we're talking, as you write in this book, closer to $45,000 to work, as you said, 21 days, 14 hours a day, 21 days out of the month, 14 hours a day. I mean, this is tough work and not particularly well compensated.
Yeah, I mean, it's the challenge is on both sides, right? Like you can be well compensated if you're a very experienced truck driver, if you are salaried at a company where you're doing the same route over and over again. But of course, most long haul truck drivers are, they're kind of just like freelancers. They really are, and they might be owner operators, or they work for a small trucking company, or if they work for a big trucking company, those tend to hire you know, the new drivers who are making the least, of course, and have the least experience with it. You know, on top of this, you know, the working conditions are very challenging. It's difficult at this point, even for truckers to find a place to sleep at night. Yes, of course, they can climb into the bunk in the back of their truck, but that's only true if they can find, you know, a berth at a truck stop or a place to stop at a state rest stop. And there is, you know, on some routes, a shortage of those. And so, you know, famously, there was a trucker who told the New York Times in 2017 that a lot of them feel like throwaway people. You know, when you're getting paid by the mile, it's piecework. And the entire system really is set up to just kind of squeeze truck drivers as much as possible.
Well, and if you're paying by the mile and you're stuck in traffic, you're not making any money.
Right. And you're also not getting paid when you're sitting for hours waiting for somebody to load or unload your truck.
Well, let's finish our journey with this USB charger. It makes it to this, what, fulfillment center, what, an Amazon warehouse or a Walmart warehouse?
Yeah, so fulfillment centers are they're the kind of nerve centers of the modern e-commerce world because they're like factories, and that's why Amazon uses so many robots within them. But their product isn't, of course, a finished good. It is the unique combination of goods that's going to go into a box that's ultimately going to be delivered to your house. But because every one of those combinations of goods that people order are unique, and because they've got to be delivered to us so quickly, that's where the kind of automation, the robots, the robotic shelves comes in. So, you have a lot of workers working in these facilities alongside the robots and the machines. And of course, they need to work at the pace of those machines, which is why there has been so much coverage. I don't need to rehash about working conditions within Amazon warehouses.
Well, you described these are people, I guess, who are sorters at some of these fulfillment centers, having to check something like 1,100 to 1,200 parcels per hour.
Well, that's at the sortation facilities. That's actually done in an automated way. But there are stowers and pickers at an Amazon facility, and they're doing hundreds of items that they're picking off of shelves per hour, and they're just kind of standing in one place doing that for 10 hours a day with a half hour for lunch and 2 15-minute breaks. But it's a lot of repetitive motion, which is why the company has acknowledged that it needs to do better in terms of preventing repetitive stress injuries among its workers.
You talked about Taylorism. You have a chapter called Bezoism for Jeff Bezos. What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, Bezosism, it's just the old, Frederick Taylor, Henry Ford system of optimizing labor, down to the second. But you add in all of this technology. So new kinds of surveillance, which can monitor, every action that a person is doing, cameras at their workstations that are watching every single thing that they do, and dinging them if they spend too much so-called time off task, right? So you're not supposed to take a break unless it's actually your break time. You're not allowed to sit down, and it's just a hyper optimization of all of the actions of people within the warehouses, and also Amazon's delivery drivers in their own branded trucks are subject to the same kind of Bezosism.
In fact, you go with a woman named Jenny, who I guess it's a UP. Is she driving a UPS truck?
Yes, so she was driving a UPS truck. In some ways, she's a contrast to some of these other workers because, of course, UPS has had a strong union for a very long time, and that naturally gives their workers a lot more agency in terms of how their work is done. It also means that the company invests in more of them, more time, more energy, more training, because it can't afford to have the same kind of turnover. Like in some ways, it's kind of stuck with its workers. So it's like, okay, we're stuck with each other. We've got to make this sustainable.
And these are the people that we see, driving around our neighborhoods.
Yeah. So anybody in that, brown uniform, that's your UPS delivery driver. But of course, these days there's tons of other types of drivers as well. You're going to see FedEx, you're going to see maybe DHL, but you're going to see lots and lots of companies who are, small businesses that are contracted by Amazon to deliver their packages in their own logistics network.
You call these industrial athletes.
Yeah, industrial athletes, I think, is a very accurate term. I mean, these folks are having to, twist and lift and, march all day long. I did a ride along with a UPS driver, and I was kind of not exiting the truck correctly. So within like 3 hours, I had back pain, and I'm a pretty active person. I'm a runner, but Jenny, who was 50, just was literally running circles around me because she knew exactly how to do her job day in and day out, even through the peak season when she's delivering hundreds of packages a day without injuring herself.
Let me get Tony to join us. He's an independent truck driver. And Tony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I wanted to make a comment as to why these costs are going up so much. I run locally. I deliver fuel. One of the big issues that we're having, and I think is one of the reasons why so many people are getting out of this as an independent, is the costs have gone up over 50% in just the past 18 months. Last year, I spent $2,600 to get a set of tires put on my truck. This year, it was just slightly over $4,000 for the same set of 8 drive tires.
Tony, when you say 18 months, is that at the start of the pandemic, or what do you think was the reason for this?
A lot of it was right at the beginning of the pandemic. We've had issues where costs have been going up and up and up. When I first got into this, a brand new truck was about $95,000. I just purchased my fourth truck a couple years ago, and it was $156,000 for the exact same truck.
Wow. So you think you're staying in this business? Are you going to stay in this business, or is it getting too expensive?
It really depends upon what happens with the rates. I know everybody is talking about how much the shipping costs have gone up, and that's, you know, obvious. The big difference is, as an independent, our rates have went up 10%, but our overall costs have gone up 50% for the same operating cost.
Wow.
Fuel, tires, any kind of parts you need for repairs, all of that has gone up at least 50%, and we're not being compensated for it. It's one of the reasons why they're having such a hard time finding people to do this work. Work is hard. The hours are long.
Tony, hold on.
You're really not getting the compensation.
No, I hear you. Tony, hold on, because let me give Christopher Mims a chance to respond to you. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, what Tony is talking about, I mean, unfortunately, it's ubiquitous in the industry. You see a lot of small trucking companies actually got wiped out at the beginning of the pandemic because there was a dip in demand as companies pulled back their orders. And so a dip in rates. And you know, yeah, now rates are going up, but, you know, shippers are trying to manage those costs. And there's a real asymmetry where it's a very fragmented industry. Lots of small trucking companies don't have the same amount of information or data as the big freight brokers or the big shippers that are hiring them. And, you know, I in a lot of ways, it's not sustainable because you squeeze more and more of these independent drivers out of the industry. Rates are going to go up one way or another.
Tony, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We've got another caller. This is Michael, and Michael is an Amazon Prime driver and warehouse worker. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. What do you have to say?
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Hey, I just was listening. I had a call in. About the hyper-efficiency is super, super true. I don't work there anymore. I've actually left for better pastures, thankfully. But, yes, working in the warehouses from 2017 to 2018, you couldn't get bathroom breaks. You would get in trouble for using the bathroom. I understand the whole joke on the internet, you know, when Bezos went to space, everyone took a bathroom break, which is very true. When I did Prime, it was the same thing. I would be out in the middle of my area was the Poconos, and there would be, like, no places to, like, use the restroom or anything like that. It was horrible. I remember my knees and my feet for standing for long periods of times, and the mats would never be changed out. Like, the hyper-efficiency will run you down to almost nothing, believe it or not.
I believe you, Michael. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Chris, going back to you and going back to warehouse workers, you say when there are complaints or even talks about unionizing, it is largely about working conditions, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, Amazon famously said, we're going to raise the bar, we're going to raise wages to $15 an hour. And depending on what part of the country, it can be a lot higher. I saw jobs in their Edison, New Jersey fulfillment center. They're offering up to $22 an hour there and a $1,000 signing bonus. That's how desperate they are for people to come work at some of these fulfillment centers. But when, you know, when workers were organizing, you know, even before what happened in Alabama with the attempt to unionize that fulfillment center, in Shakopee, Minnesota, you know, when workers were walking out, they just said, hey, like, we want more breaks. And, you know, and a lot of them were immigrants and they were Muslim. And they were like, we want the opportunity to pray because this is really important to us. And Amazon's just not set up that way. It's a very performance driven culture, and it's management by algorithm. So if you are too long off task, if you're taking too many breaks, the algorithm is going to notice. And your human boss might come along and say, oh, I'm here to help you out and help train you and everything. But ultimately, you're answering to a piece of software. So, you know, there's no mercy there.
Michael, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You write about a place called Fulfillment Center Alley in Pennsylvania. Where is that?
So if you imagine kind of the corridor, roughly correlating with maybe the Appalachian Trail, of areas where there's enough highways and enough, you know, people who need jobs, but it's within an hour or two's drive of the major population centers on the East Coast. That's Fulfillment Center Alley on that side of the country. And tons of companies, everybody who wants to deliver things to you online, which is everybody now, sets up their big e-commerce fulfillment centers there and sort of competes with each other for labor, whether it's you know, Amazon or Walmart or Chewy or Lowe's or any of them.
We have a bunch of comments here. They're all pretty much about the same thing. Elizabeth says, what we really need to do is curb global warming. It's to stop shopping. Olivia says, can you comment on the environmental impact of shipping all these products around the world? A tweet from Ivan, I shop sparingly online because of the ethical problems of the process and the companies involved. Christine says, most of the supply chain runs on oil, which is so damaging to climate. What's the chance of getting more renewables into the mix? I mean, these are people who probably don't shop online or don't do it very much. And they have problems with the system. Do you too as well, Chris? Especially after having spent some time really doing in this deep dive.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I hope people take away from this book is that, you know, there are no... When something gets delivered to you, every time it is a miracle. If you could have ridden along on the journey that thing traveled, it would just absolutely floor you. And it has made me want to buy less and make things last longer, and it has made me much more conscientious about where things come from. You know, that said, I know that so many of us are busy, we're pressed for time, you know, people are rushing to get their kids to school and get to work, and you know, we all just need, we're a tool using species, we need things in our life, and so we just pick up whatever is at hand, whatever is affordable, you know, whether that's from Amazon or Walmart or wherever. But I do think that we kind of can and should be more collectively conscientious about this thing. You know, we should be limiting our consumption, and we should keep in mind that these systems are really designed to tap into our most primitive reptilian brain, where it's so convenient to just click buy now. That's the whole point. That's why the system was designed the way it was.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it's so convenient, right? And it's just this click away, which is so easy to do without even thinking. But you're saying what? Think, pause before you click?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you put it in your shopping cart, give it a week, see if you still really need it, see if there's something you can you know, reuse as an alternative. Because you know, what the commenter who said much of the supply chain runs on oil is absolutely right. You know, for a lot of this stuff, there is no alternative. If it came to you on a ship, that ship burned bunker fuel. It is the dirtiest fossil fuel you can burn, aside from maybe coal. There's just no way around it. Long haul trucks are not going to get electrified anytime soon. The physics just don't work. So, you know, the further away something came from, you know, the larger its impact on the environment. There's no way around it.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time. You mentioned miracle, and just because you've got something in the case of this USB charger that starts in, you know, a factory in Vietnam, and lo and behold, ends up on someone's front door.
Yeah. I mean, as I said before, it's a 14,000 mile multi-month journey with just untold amounts of automation, robotics, and humans, you know, some of whom were really kind of pushing themselves to the limit in order to get that one single tiny, absolutely mundane item to you.
I want to end with a comment from Carol to you, Christopher Mim. She says, I just want to shout out Christopher's great technology reporting. I love his columns.
Well, I really appreciate that.
Well, we appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Christopher Mims, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. He's technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And again, we've been talking about his new book. It's called Arriving Today, From Factory to Front Door, Why Everything Has Changed About How and What We Buy. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can always continue this conversation on our Facebook page. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those calls and comments.